Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Breakfast. It's the most important meal of the day, or so we've been taught. Aside from feeling fuller, longer, breakfast eaters are thought to benefit from a host of health-related gains, including lowered risk of diabetes and coronary heart disease. But wait, a recent study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition has revealed that when it comes to weight loss, breakfast eaters are no better off or possibly even worse off than people who skip or skimp on the morning meal. Joining us by phone is registered dietitian and wellness manager for the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute, Kristen Kirkpatrick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be on.
Also from the University of Alabama, Birmingham's Nutrition Obesity Research Center, Dr. Andrew Brown. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Brown, you didn't conduct the study I just mentioned, but you've researched breakfast-related health benefits before. What have you found about the connection between weight and the morning meal?
Right. So we've looked at a lot of studies to do with breakfast and either energy intake or weight. And in particular, we specifically look at breakfast eating versus breakfast skipping, because that's usually the recommendation you hear. You'll hear people say you have to eat something. And so we just really weren't sure what the data had to say about that. So when we went and systematically reviewed the literature, we saw that there was really very little research looking at actually eating versus skipping breakfast in the gold standard type of study design, which is the randomized controlled trial. But there was plenty of observational evidence showing the association. So what we've recently done is taken that a step further to actually systematically review the randomized controlled trials, and overall, there's really no effect between people that were randomized to eat or skip breakfast and changes in body weight.
Where do we know, Kristen Kirkpatrick, where this idea of eating breakfast comes from? Because we all sort of grew up with it, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right, this is what exactly our mothers would say to us when we woke up before going to school. But in some ways, I think that's where a lot of the studies kind of stemmed, was looking at the actual breakfast program in schools and how we have associations with kids performing better on tests. We did have some associations with weight, et cetera. There's plenty of studies that do show that. So I think those were some stronger studies that we said, okay, well, you know, this is something that's really working well in our younger populations. And then the whole idea of kind of breaking the fast. So we go to bed, we don't eat anything for anywhere from 6 to 12 hours. And then when we wake up, we have this analogy of the car needing gas and we need to break the fast. So I think that's kind of a combination of where the idea that you absolutely can't start your day without breakfast is coming from.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're kicking it off with a discussion about breakfast. If you're doing it on an empty stomach, the research shows you aren't any worse off necessarily than someone who took the time to make breakfast. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dr. Brown, were the research that you reviewed, was there a difference in age issues? In other words, I don't think anyone wants to send a kid to school hungry, because then they're just thinking about their growling stomach and maybe not focused on the teacher. So it's not necessarily a nutrition thing, but a behavior thing.
Right, and that's something that people are actively studying, but certainly in terms of weight, there really haven't been those studies done in children. So the only ones that we've really been able to find were in adults. And, you know, so that's a situation where interpreting our research sometimes gets a little bit fuzzy. People will say, oh, well, it doesn't matter if you eat breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what we're really saying is we just don't know at this point, which is a very unsatisfying answer to hear. But, you know, and certainly in terms of sending a kid to school on an empty stomach is not what we're recommending from this research. What we're recommending is to either do those stronger studies, or if we feel collectively comfortable with the way the data are, then you know, we can stop there, but it's just the communication that we know for sure that breakfast causes weight loss or, you know, will in childhood obesity just are things that the research does not show at this point.
Kristen Kirkpatrick, what does breakfast do to your metabolism in the morning? I guess, for one thing, it depends on what you're eating for breakfast, if it's a nice kale smoothie or bacon and eggs and toast.
Right. Well, I mean, that's really the question there, is that it's really dependent on whether or not you're giving your body something that's going to feed into increasing insulin and blood sugar. And that could be something as simple as a bagel or something as really, really offensive as something very sugary like a Danish. So it depends on that. It also depends on the amount of protein. So there is a large amount of research that looks at the impact of protein in the breakfast and how that then impacts your eating habits throughout the rest of the day. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, it's really that kind of boils down to what are you eating? I think we have this perception of what breakfast looks like, and for a lot of people, that's breakfast cereals sometimes, which tend to be incredibly high in sugar. Even if they're whole grains, there's really not a huge amount of really great options there for that. And then, of course, the kind of the bad rap that eggs have gotten all those years, which we're now kind of reversing. So I think it really boils down to the choice and how that's going to impact you, whether negatively or positively.
So, Dr. Andrew Brown, is there much research out there at all about the impact on our health, weight gain, that sort of thing, when it comes to when we eat? So I could eat late, you know, after 8 p.m. and it won't make any difference. Is the research, is there anything on that?
Well, we've published on that, too. That's kind of this bigger issue of eating frequency versus time of day. And there's recommendations people have. You should only eat between 8 and 5, or there's people that say you shouldn't eat after a certain time, or there's some people that say you have to eat breakfast at 7 o'clock. And so there's all these different recommendations, but again, the science behind them isn't as strong as it needs to be, I think, to convince everybody. Now, that's a little bit different, I think, than working, for instance, with a dietitian on a personalized program. I think that's a little bit different. But for the blanket recommendations for when to eat, they're definitely your body does definitely respond differently if you have a extended fast versus if you're eating every couple of hours. But again, what effect that necessarily has on obesity, the evidence is really kind of just non-conclusive. In particular, talking about, you know, what types of foods you eat in the morning, there's been all kinds of studies looking at eating versus skipping breakfast on intake later on in the day.
Right.
And often when you look at the lunch meal, yeah, people end up eating more at lunch. But when you total all the calories that they've eaten, you actually see that there's no difference. Or sometimes when people have eaten breakfast that they consume fewer calories when skipping the breakfast total in the day. And yet, despite that, we often don't see differences in weight. So it just kind of gets back to the idea that the body really is a rather adaptable machine in that regard. And so trying to affect weight is a very difficult thing. And some of the simple recommendations don't seem to be having much of an effect.
Nothing simple. So, when you talk about these randomized studies, did it randomize for not just intake, but also how many calories people burn in a day?
So a lot of these studies that we looked at were the eating versus skipping. So there have been other studies that look at type of breakfast. There's not a whole lot of those, but there are some. But we just stuck to eating versus skipping breakfast. So we don't, you know, we're not able to distinguish whether it's the high protein versus a high carb, or some of these studies allowed people just to eat whatever they wanted. And so it really was just, this group is told to eat breakfast, this group is told to skip breakfast. So it's really getting at that simple message that we often hear, that, you know, you can't skip breakfast. And so in that regard, there were studies where some people were told to eat a higher protein diet or a higher carbohydrate diet. And one, they were looking at an oat porridge and corn flakes, and just looking at those types of things. And in those cases, they did not really see a difference. One study showed that the water group, so the fasting group actually lost significantly more weight. One study showed a high protein group lost a little more fat mass, but the effect across all the studies is null.
Hmm. Kristen Kirkpatrick, where do we get our ideas for what breakfast should be? It sounds like it mostly comes from people who want to sell us something at this point.
Oh, definitely. Food marketing is very big, and there's imagine how big the cereal aisle is. It's like it has its own aisle. What other food could you really say to that? But I think we need to kind of rethink breakfast and think out of the box. Dr. Brown had brought up the idea of actual fasting and intermittent fasting, and there's so many positive studies there. So, number one, rethink when you actually eat that first meal of the day and whether that's considered breakfast or a late morning snack, right? And then looking at things like intact carbohydrates. So you don't really want to have cornflakes that are very high in the glycemic index. You want something more intact that your body really has to work very hard to process. So oatmeal would be a great example of an intact carbohydrate. Even having just a handful of nuts, things that aren't impacting your insulin, your blood sugar, things like that. Protein shakes, things that if you're trying to get out of the house and you really want to have something to eat, a lot of times you can find very good, high-quality protein shakes that you make on your own that you're not purchasing. So I think it really, a lot of times in my practice, it boils down to the patients. I have patients that will skip breakfast and say they are just eating the entire vending machine by 10:30. And I have others that will eat breakfast and say, I had two eggs this morning and I wasn't hungry until 3.
Uh-huh.
So I think there's a lot of things that, yes, we want to stay evidence-based, of course, but there's also a lot of things that either genetically or environmentally that are impacting people's hunger. And so at the end of the day, for my patients, that is what is driving overeating and making really unhealthy choices.
And you do it on a case-by-case basis. A diet for one person would not, or I should say a menu for one person would not be what you'd have for another.
Absolutely right. You have to look at everyone as an individual and what works for them. So, and even like preferences. So someone, you might say to someone, well, steel cut oats are a great option and we want to add protein to it. And their first thing out of their mouth could be like, oh no, I hate oatmeal.
Yeah.
So then you look at another option. But the key is to think out of the box and not go for things that are marketed as breakfast foods. Right? You never want to pick your breakfast sandwich out of the frozen aisle. That's definitely for sure. And you probably don't want to get it through the window of your car as well. So there's a lot of options there, but we have to think beyond this is a quote-unquote breakfast food, right? A handful of nuts doesn't sound like a breakfast food, but in my world it is. So it's just thinking of what kind of fuel do you want to give yourself in the morning, and that could be early morning or late morning, or that could be closer to lunch. But it's really dependent on what's going to be the best fuel to help with disease prevention and then keeping your weight either down or losing weight.
Dr. Brown, do you go bonkers kind of a little bit with the way, particularly Americans, just zigzag all over the place based on the latest research?
Well, it is a little bit entertaining but frustrating. That's a lot of the work that we do is on research communication. I've been trying to be very precise in what I've been saying today, mm-hmm. that we're only looking at eating versus skipping breakfast. And certainly after hearing Kristen's comments about, that comes down to the individual, that's one thing that I did forget to specify was that this is looking at a group of people on average. So we don't know necessarily if one person would do better or worse on this. We're just looking at if we were to take a group of people and say on average, what should the average person do? We're seeing there's not necessarily a difference. And that I think is where a lot of the miscommunication and the misunderstanding comes from. Is we can have this study come out and say there's no difference between eaters and skippers when they're randomized. And just like was already said, somebody will go, boy, if I don't have breakfast, I lose my mind.
Mm-hmm.
What we found after our earlier study, this is completely anecdotal, but there are people that actually feel oppressed by breakfast. They're just not hungry in the morning. And then they get, you know, they get all kinds of advice that they should have eaten breakfast. And they're like, I'm just not hungry. I don't feel good when I eat breakfast. And so it gets very difficult to communicate the research about something so personal and so experiential as food.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Andrew Brown, for talking with us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Andrew Brown, he's a scientist with the University of Alabama, Birmingham's Nutrition Obesity Research Center. And Kristen Kirkpatrick, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Kristen Kirkpatrick is a registered dietitian and wellness manager for the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The NBC reality show The Biggest Loser has been a hit since it debuted in 2004. Contestants are pushed to shed the pounds through diet and exercise. You'll see them flipping tractor tires in a field and sweating it out on a treadmill. And their diets minimize daily calories, so at the end of the 30-week competition, they've lost a lot of weight. A recently published study revealed, however, that most of the season 8 contestants lost most of the ground they had gained during the competition. Just one of the 14 Biggest Loser Season 8 contestants studied had kept off the weight. Researchers blamed slowed metabolism, which suggests that success could be hopeless for some. We talked about this all a few weeks ago on Wellness Wednesday. Now some former Biggest Loser competitors want to talk about this. They aren't where they were, but they are better off in the long run, they say. Joining us now by phone from Detroit is Carla Triplett, who competed in Season 7 of The Biggest Loser. Welcome to the show, Carla.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me.
And from Idaho, Moses Kani, who competed in Season 11. Welcome to Moses. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ann. Appreciate it.
You lost, Moses, 153 pounds on The Biggest Loser. I don't know if you won or not, but wow, that is a huge amount of weight to lose. You've gained back about 80 pounds since it ended, but you believe half of that is muscle. So tell us about how you view yourself in terms of success or failure or wherever in between.
Well, that's a really good question. Yeah, because you know that study that they talk about, and I'm friends with pretty much almost all of season 8 that did that there. And I understand their struggle just like them. I did the show with my daughter, Kaylee, and sadly, my daughter, Kaylee, is very much like them. She not only has gained all her weight, but she's lost she's gained even more than that. And she goes through her struggles just like all of us do. I gained about 85 pounds. But mine, when I left the show, I was eliminated in New Zealand. And they gave me this pep talk that, okay, Moses, we want you to go home and continue to keep losing more weight. And I actually told them that then I said, you know what? I'm going to go home and I'm going to try to put muscle back on me. Because when Well, I knew that when I came home, my wife saw me. She goes, honey, you look great. You look thin, but you look weak.
Huh.
And at that time, my wife had never in 27 years had she ever told me I look weak. And when you tell a Tongan man that he looks weak, and Carla is familiar with Tongans because she was on there with Sean and Felipe, which is the first ever Tongan. Yeah, that was just not something I wanted to hear. And my wife was right. When you lose a lot of weight so fast, you do lose a lot of muscle mass.
Yeah.
And I knew I was going to come home, and I put on, I'd probably say about 45 pounds of muscle, and it feels great. But sadly, I'd probably add another 40 pounds of fat that I did not.
Go ahead.
I just fight for it every day. I fight every day like everybody in the real world does.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'll never lose hope. I'm grateful for what happened to me on the decision. And I understand the study, but the fact is that, you know, somebody asked me, because I am a personal trainer right now at a club here in Idaho Falls, and people ask me, you know, why do we even keep working at it? If your body's going to fight to gain all that weight back, and I said, then why even bother getting up? Why even brush your teeth? Why do any of that? And so we can have a better life. I'm going to fight every day for it.
Well, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Carla Triplett, Moses Kanikany is talking about this larger overall sense of wellness that he wanted to achieve. And it involved gaining a little weight or gaining quite a bit of weight, but compared to what he lost, pretty much about half, and he says half his muscle. What about that overall feeling of well-being?
The overall feeling of well-being is, I mean, when you lose the weight, of course, you're excited, you're happy, you're motivated. But let me say this, because my season was different than most of the seasons for the show.
Okay.
On season 7, our team split up. So half of our teams went home and the other half stayed on the ranch. And I was one of the teammates that went home, along with Nicole Brewer, who was also on the show with me. Now, when we went home, they taught us what we need to do while we were at home. So we never got that experience on the ranch, per se, because we were gone for 30 days.
Okay.
So we learned how to manage our weight, exercise, keep it off, what we need to do to maintain it. So I, when at the finale, I did lose 128 pounds. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to keep my weight off for a good, I'll say up until 2013. Mm-hmm. 2013, I went through a whole thing with like my marriage, my career. And I stopped doing the thing that I was doing when I left the show, because I even became a Zumba instructor. So I was teaching Zumba every day. I was still working out. But also in the midst of that, having to like travel, you get consumed with everything else that's going on, where you start slacking in what you're doing. Now, I'm not taking away from those who have gained their weight back and those who have maintained to keep it off. But like my experience was totally different, because I was able to maintain my weight. Now, during that period of 2013 to say the present, I gained back 75 to 80 pounds. However, it wasn't, you know, that automatic weight gain right after the show. Mine just started coming back on. So it's been a few years that I've started gaining my weight back. And I share with people, and I say it as a joke. I said, how can I be fat when I was on the Biggest Loser? I was like, you know, I can't be a Biggest Loser and I'm still fat. So I show people what I'm doing consistently every day. Now, I think that's how I'm able to maintain my well-being, because people accept that. And you have to be honest with yourself, and you have to be honest with other people. I never hid my weight gain, because mm-hmm. I'm still out in the public and people are seeing me. So, you know, they know, oh, you still look good. So I love that.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that Healthy Wage has reached out to former contestants with giving back and coaching others to lose weight. But in addition to helping coach others to lose weight, I took it upon myself to say, you know what, I'm not just going to coach these people.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get back on the ball running too. Now, I'm not participating in the actual jackpot incentive. I'm losing weight along beside my team.
Okay.
To lead by example, because you can't be a great coach and tell someone else what to do if you're not doing it yourself.
Right. Let me ask both of you about an idea that someone brought up to me recently after I had, you know, talked about that study a couple weeks ago on the season 8 contestants. Someone came to talk to me. They'd lost a lot of weight and they said, you know, and they've kept it off so far. They talked about sort of rewiring their brain, rewiring how they view their life and how they view themselves. And Moses, can you talk about that a little bit? Did you experience that? Have you experienced that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I do because, you know, we were taught all the right things on the show.
Yeah.
About nutrition, about exercise, and we practice that every day. I think one of the things that I hope the Biggest Loser from now on can address even more so was really we had to figure out how our relationship with food. How do we take this? Because even though we did all this stuff, you still have to be able to manage, not only how your relationship with food, but how do you look at yourself? You know, are you proud of what you did? And where you're going, you know, I love, first of all, I'm a huge fan of Carla. I loved watching her.
Well, thank you,
Mom. I felt you were ripped off. You know your story. I know your story.
Yes.
And I was cheering for you from Idaho the whole time. But I'd love to hear what she says to you because, we are now in the real world. And I look very positive on what I do. I am a personal trainer, and I work with people every day. I'm right in front of them, and what I love is that people see that, hey, even though I've been on The Biggest Loser, I struggle just like they do. I fight every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And Carla and I are both involved with Healthy Waves right now, which is a wonderful opportunity to help people lose weight that healthy way.
Carla Triplett?
Yes.
Go ahead. I mean, as far as that rewiring goes, kind of
And this is what they told me when I went on the show,
mm-hmm.
that this weight loss thing is more mental than it is physical. Once you decide in your mind that you want to lose weight, you're going to do it. If you're not mentally prepared to do this, you're going to fail each time.
And the same thing goes for keeping it off, right?
And keeping it off.
Yeah.
Once you lose the weight, you cannot just stop and say, okay, I lost the weight. Now if you want to be skinny, fine. Because I've never been skinny. I'm not trying to be skinny.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be healthy. But you can't just stop and say, okay, I lost the weight. Now it's going to stay off. You have to continue to do the things that you did to lose the weight. And that's what happened to me. I can't speak for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped doing things that I was supposed to do to lose the weight. Like, I used to work out in the morning and in the evening. I won't work out in the morning. I'll work out in the evening. The evening comes, I don't work out in the evening. So here I am, not working out none at the time.
At all.
But I'm still eating because I'm addicted to food. I tell people that. I've been like that since the show. I'm addicted to food, and that's what most people have, is an addiction to food, because we've been overweight pretty much most of our lives. Food is our comfort. Once we learn how to manage that, you can still eat healthy and overeat. People don't know that.
Right. Well,
there are days when you want to have, like, something sweet, something bad. You might want a burger, you want a pizza, but have half of it. Like, you have to train yourself. I can't eat the whole thing. Let me eat half of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you eat a burger, don't eat the bun. Like, you can still have the burger. Just don't eat the bun. Like, there are things that you can do to offset that. And that's what, while I'm coaching my team, this is what I teach them. Because I am surprised myself. I have the number one team throughout the entire competition in this healthy weight loss challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm shocked because I didn't know that this one group of people was going to take off like they did. Like, everything I told them is exactly what happened to me on the show. I said, this is what's going to happen in week 1, week 2. You're going to be like, okay, what's going on? you're going to want to give up. This is the time that you need to really kick it in gear. Mm-hmm. Week three, you're going to see who falls off, who's going to keep going. Week four, you're going to have urges. You're going to get tired. I mean, there's so many things that's going on each week that you have to be prepared for mentally. I said, and then when you hit your plateau, don't get discouraged with that. Just know that your body doesn't have that extra weight on it that helps you lose the weight. So now you
yeah.
have to eat
right.
increase your resistance.
Well, that goes to that metabolism question. I wanted to ask you both before I have to let you go about that research and about your metabolism. The research found that the metabolism slowed, and that was the culprit. That's why these season eight contestants couldn't keep the weight off. Moses Kinney, did you notice that?
I believe because I learned all those things, and now I do this here, and things don't seem to drop off like they did when I was on the show.
Right.
And I accept that. I know that I believe it was the Washington Post came out with another article, and they didn't dispute that. They said, well, their studies have it that, yeah, there is a little bit of slowing of the metabolism. It might not be the 400 to 500 that the New York Times said, but it was probably more like maybe 100 to 200. But regardless of what it is, because, yeah, I think that has affected me. But I just tell people, like, you know what? It doesn't really matter.
Okay.
So you're handicapped a little bit more, so you fight harder. I'm going, but just do it the healthy way. I love what I've done on there. But the fact is, you need to lose 1 to 2 pounds a week, and it's a much better lifestyle to do it that way.
Yeah. Carla Triplett?
Yes, and now that we know that the metabolism slows down even after we lose weight, we can research to find out what we can do to increase our metabolism. Because, one, you're getting older, so you don't.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
When I was 36, so I had that energy. Like, I can really tell, like, I need something to boost my metabolism. Now, I heard that the organic Bragg's apple cider vinegar, I take a shot of that every morning, and I feel like, okay, it's helping me. It curbs my appetite, you know. So it's like there are other things that you can do if you know that this is what's going to happen or you know that this is happening. Let's research and find out, okay, what do we need to do in order to increase our metabolism? Because we know that it's decreased. So let's find out what we need to do in order to boost it back up so we can get back on track. But in order to do that, you have to really, like, it's that mental thing. Because even during this challenge, I was ready to, I said, you know what, I don't want to work out today. And I said, I can't do that. I post a daily challenge every day in my group. When I didn't post a daily challenge for 3 days, they were, like, inboxing me and calling me, like, what is wrong with you? And I said, I really don't feel like working out today. I don't want to get out the bed. It was more mental than physical. Yeah. It was a beautiful day outside, but I psyched myself out.
Yeah.
But you know what? And it's always good to have someone there to motivate you, because people don't understand. They think you are this superhero because you've been on The Biggest Loser. No, we need help, too. We need encouragement, too. We need motivation, too.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's Moses Kinney, season 11 contestant on The Biggest Loser, and also Carla Triplett, season 7 contestant on The Biggest Loser. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Cymbalta. Today, about 30 million Americans take antidepressants like them. In fact, a review in 2011 found that antidepressants were the second most commonly prescribed medication after drugs to lower cholesterol. Dr. Kelly Brogan, certified as both a psychiatrist and an integrative holistic medicine, has explored alternative drug-free methods for dealing with anxiety and depression. She's co-written a book about her work. It's entitled A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Heal Their Bodies to Reclaim Their Lives. Dr. Brogan joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Total pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is a psychiatrist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Tamar Gore. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here today.
Dr. Brogan, you focused your research on, or your studies or your exploration on women. Why was that?
I actually specialize at the fellowship level in something psychiatry, which is essentially helping women who are in their reproductive years, either planning a pregnancy, pregnant, or postpartum, to determine through informed consent, really, whether taking psychiatric medications is best for them during pregnancy and breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. So I have a practice that is comprised almost entirely of women, and I've always sort of fancied myself a women's health advocate. And so there's really nothing in the book that's really that gender oriented,
okay,
but it is the market I'm looking to focus on.
You say that there's never been a study that proves that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, have the studies shown to get these drugs on the market then?
Yeah, it's an interesting history. I should preface this by saying that I very much come from the conventional mindset. For many, many years, believe that perfect health is only one prescription away. I spent my entire career focusing on psychopharmacology and doing my best to help patients through pharmaceutical products. And it wasn't until I began to look into the research behind what is called the monoamine hypothesis that I began to understand, mostly through the work of pioneering thinkers like Joanna Moncrief and David Healy, who are psychiatrists in the UK, that in 60 years, since the inception of really the pharmaceutical model of psychiatry, which itself is an interesting story, that there is no valid research that confirms that there is any such thing as a chemical imbalance underpinning depression. And that's probably because depression isn't an entity. It is not genetically driven in the way we wish and hope and would like it to be. It is not predictable in the way that it would be if it were based on a single mechanism. And it doesn't follow any of the properties that we would expect biochemically and physiologically if it were based on a serotonin imbalance, for example, whether it's an insufficiency or, an abundance. So we really have, researchers have gone beyond it. They're beginning to look at what's called the cytokine theory. But in clinical practice, it takes about 17 years for doctors to be exposed to what modern science is really demonstrating. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the awkward window we're in right now.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tamar Gore, in your practice as a psychiatrist at OSU, how do you weigh the pros and the cons when it comes to prescribing a chemical to somebody to treat a mental illness?
Sure, that's an excellent question, and I'll get to it in a moment. But I just wanted to address one of the issues the other doctor raised.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's true that the monoamine hypothesis has fallen out of favor by many psychiatrists, antidepressants don't just work through increasing serotonin or norepinephrine or whatever they're targeted at.
Mm-hmm.
They actually do increase neurogenesis in the brain.
What does that mean?
So we were taught in medical school, and we're commonly taught that you're born with all the brain cells that you have, and they just get pruned away
mm-hmm.
over the years. But in fact, there is a robust population in the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that's very important for memory, but also for mood and anxiety regulation, where there is the birth of new neurons. And that seems to be very important. Stress can reduce the production of new neurons in that part of the brain. And antidepressants like Celexa and some of the other ones that you mentioned have actually been demonstrated to increase neurogenesis in the part of the brain. And that takes about 3 to 6 weeks to work, which does reflect the time frame that most antidepressants take to work. So more and more we're walking away from saying, well, it's just serotonin going up, to really seeing what's downstream of serotonin, which many scientists, many psychiatrists now think might be neurogenesis. So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, well, so, as a psychiatrist, how do you decide what to prescribe somebody, knowing all of that?
So first of all, you know, I'm on every patient is a case by case basis.
Everyone's a snowflake, right? Yeah.
Everyone is a snowflake. Yeah. I like that you said that. But we make sure to take a very thorough history, find out what they've taken before that has worked or what hasn't worked, gauge how severe their depression is. So I do not tend to use antidepressants to treat mild or moderate depression, as there isn't very good evidence that it works to treat those disorders. But when it is a severe depression, which might involve feeling like you don't want to live anymore, really not having much of a life for yourself, not being able to enjoy things, not having good energy, I do go ahead and start people on, and I only do treat women as well, actually, on antidepressants in order to improve their mood and decrease their suicidality.
So, Dr. Kelly Brogan, you relate to what Dr. Gore is saying. You did that too, and you've changed. Talk about what you mean by alternatives to say I'm a candidate for Celexa. I have depression related anxiety, blah blah blah, whatever it might be. But what do you do instead?
Yeah, so I so appreciate Dr. Gore, you know, what you've shared, and I very much have spent some time in that literature, and also the fact, you know, it's interesting and worth noting that antidepressants have also been shown in some preliminary research to have anti-inflammatory effects, mm-hmm. right?
So yes, they have.
You know, you might So you might sort of be left with this feeling like, well, they work sometimes, but we don't really know how, and we're just figuring out how. And I really, really love the idea of there being, you know, a safe, effective intervention for people who really need it. And I think what we have to grapple with as a guild, you know, psychiatry as a guild, mm-hmm. Is the fact that there is a signal of harm that I was never made aware of in my decade of Ivy League training. And now that I have begun to dig into the non-industry funded literature, it's given me tremendous pause. And, you know, so one of the things I just want to touch on before I answer your question is the research that has really been in the literature for several decades now, and there have been some mouthpieces behind it, again, with Healy and Dr. Peter Bregan, and actually several parent activists, that suggests that there are many patients who are born with what are called 2D6 or liver cytochrome variants. So this is a gene variant that changes the way that you metabolize toxicants and specifically pharmaceutical products, and that these patients are more likely actually to commit suicide and homicide in what's called akathisia-induced impulsivity. So when we are trying to help our patients who are struggling and those who are, you know, hopeless to the extent that they're thinking of harming themselves, mm-hmm. what we might be offering them is almost like I've said, you know, it's almost like offering someone who's falling off a cliff a knife to hold on to, right? So there has to be a better way. And that's pretty much the conclusion I've come to. It's understanding that depression, as you've mentioned, Dr. Gore, is never just one thing, right? So there are many potential drivers, many of which are reversible, physiologic imbalances, whether it's low thyroid function or specific food intolerances, or even dysglycemia or blood sugar imbalance, right? These are reversible physiologic problems that can be labeled as psychiatric if you don't know how to look for them, right? So while everyone has their own road to depression, we acknowledge it's not just one thing, then the most, you know, the sort of physician's oath, right? The first do no harm path of intervention has to involve restoring resiliency and health to the body first, mm-hmm. before understanding even what we're looking at. But that's really the extent of my alternative methodology.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to go back to the imagery of falling off a cliff and handing somebody a knife. What if that knife can help you? You can jam it into the side of the cliff and stop you from falling off and dying.
Yeah.
I mean, so Dr. Tamar Gore, you're talking about maybe giving somebody something on a short-term basis to steady them.
Yes, I mean, I think that, so, you know, it's not like I send people off into the wilderness with an antidepressant. I bring them back frequently, make sure they're getting better. We make adjustments. And I'm a very firm believer in a sound mind and a sound body. So I make sure that part of the treatment plan includes, you know, reaching out to their social supports, to their spouse, to their loved ones, making sure they get support that way, making sure they're getting enough exercise, enough sleep, good nutrition. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I feel like there's a one-size-fit-all with a
antidepressant. I mean, there's an art to psychiatry and not just a science. And in speaking to the science, I feel like, 10 years from now, I used to say 20 years from now, but I really think within 10 years, we'll be able to have people come in and give them a personalized approach based on working up their, what are their liver enzymes? What is their genetic profile? And have a more personalized approach. What is their inflammation? What is their inflammatory profile? How severe is their inflammation? Should I
target
that?
What does a brain
scan
show?
What is a brain, what is a brain scan show? What is their microbiome? What are the bacteria in their gut? What is that revealing about them? And I think we will get to that point. I just think that we do the best we have with what we have right now and what the evidence that we have right now.
Could I ask you both something that I talk about a lot in this program, and we never seem to get to the bottom of it, and I want to know what your thoughts are. Dr. Kelly Brogan, what about the shortage of psychiatrists? What if we had a shortage of things to wear? We'd have to walk around naked. I mean, there are not enough psychiatrists, particularly for young males. Dr. Brogan, what about that? What do you see that as a problem?
It's funny. No, I don't actually. I actually echo the sentiments of the director of the Nordic Cochrane Group, Dr. Peter Gauthier, when he said that psychiatry needs to be halted as a profession. I actually have come to the perspective that it does more harm than good, and that there are really only risks and unexplored long-term damages when you explore the literature about outcomes short-term and long-term, and you investigate these, the potential for vast harm befalling our society at the hands of practitioners who mean absolutely well. And the doctors that I work with, some of my best friends are psychiatrists. I'm one myself. You know, these are people who mean well. They want to help their patients, but the tools that they have been given are harmful. And I have come to believe that very passionately. So it's, many, many, all over the world, people contact me and tell me, well, how do I find an integrative psychiatrist? How do I find a functional medicine doctor who can help me get off medication? And, the truth is there's no need for specialties when you are appreciating the wholeness of a human being. There's no specialties dissolve. So specialties is an old antiquated model of different organ systems being relegated to different professions. And that model needs to die because modern science shows that intersystem connectivity and complexity are the way that we will actually help resolve some of the chronic and debilitating degenerative problems that are, confronting our society. So I'm actually not in support of more treatment.
Okay.
Psychiatrist, quite the opposite.
Okay, Dr. Gore?
Well, I couldn't disagree more strongly and respectfully with Dr. Brogan. And I think that my colleagues who are on the front lines here and know that the wait times in our ERs for those in crisis are long, and know that the wait times to get in with a practitioner are long, and that there are people who don't want to live anymore and who need our help, and people who are struggling with severe mental illness for whom maybe we are imperfect, but for whom we are the last hope. And I think that, I think there's a lot of problems with our health system in the United States. And one of them is that mental illness, both treatment and research, is severely underfunded and severely ignored. And, someone will walk into a theater and shoot people, and then we'll get a blip of interest in it. Mm-hmm. But then that will quickly die down. And I think that we need more people to speak out about seeking treatment. And I think that I speak for myself as both a scientist and a psychiatrist and say that I work passionately every day to try to understand what is happening during pregnancy, stress during pregnancy that impacts the developing brain. And I'm not doing that because I'm going to be funded or get money for it. I do it because I want to help those babies and I want to help those moms. And I think that an evidence-based approach is the strongest. And I think that we are in an exciting time where we are getting more and more information about the microbiome and about inflammation, and that I feel like psychiatrists can play a really important role in improving mental health.
But the way you described it earlier, and we're basically out of time, but the role is expanding. You are part nutritionist, part,
It is expanding.
Physiology, right. Yeah.
It is expanding, and I think that...
It says that if you... Go ahead.
No, I'm not... Go ahead.
Dr. Okay, Brogan, we just have about 30 seconds.
Okay. If you really embrace what it is that you're talking about in terms of nutrition, microbiome, there's no need for the pills. That would be my closing parting word.
I don't think we're there yet in terms of scientific evidence.
All right. Well, I really appreciate both of you being on the show. Dr. Kelly Brogan, thanks to you.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Dr. Kelly Brogan is author of A Mind of Your Own, and Dr. Tamar Gore, thanks to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Tamar Gore is a psychiatrist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.